Welcome back to the Faculty Backbeat Podcast. I'm Kim Skorupski here at Hopkins, looking at a frequent flyer here in the podcast, Dr. Farzana Haque. Hi, Farzana.
Hi, very happy to be here.
Again, happy to be here again, because folks, episode number 263, not too long ago, I know we've been over 200 and creeping up on 275 episodes, Dr. Farzana Haque talked about embracing culture over strategy. And in that episode, which is really interesting, we talked about cool things like under-promising, over-delivering, the reputation can be destroyed in a moment, know your limits, share and seek feedback, all this really important concepts that we need to have as leaders and faculty members. So check out that episode. But during that episode, Farzana was talking about emotional intelligence and how powerful that is. And recently, Dr. Haque was telling me she was invited to give a talk, and she'll tell you about the professional society she gave this talk to. And she thought she'd come on the podcast today and talk about strategies for unlocking our leadership potential through emotional intelligence. In case you didn't listen to episode 263, you want to know who again is Dr. Farzana Haque. She is an associate professor of medicine, the acting internship co-director at St. Louis University School of Medicine, and she is the president of the Society of Hospital Medicine, St. Louis's chapter. So, Farzana, take it away.
So, you know, today we are talking about one of my passion, and truly, you know, I believe a important topic for all of us, and that is emotional intelligence. And I firmly believe that emotional intelligence is that mantra that helps us to establish our credibility as leader, irrespective of our career stage.
That's important, Farzana, irrespective of leadership role and career stage. I love that you emphasize that, because so many times when we talk with early career faculty members, we say, welcome to the leadership program. And they think, I'm not a leader yet. And we say, yes, you're a leader. And they say, no, I'm not. I don't have the big fancy role, the big fancy title. I'm new to academic medicine. And we remind faculty members that leadership is a behavior. It's a positional affect. It's not only a role or a title or money or power. It is where we are. Every stage we are, we're leading somebody in some group. So thank you for reminding us all that each of us is a leader wherever we are in many different domains. So thanks for that.
Yeah, I echo that. You know, all of us are leader, and definitely, you know, any healthcare professionals, we are leader in healthcare setting, and regardless of our job title, when at the morning we are waking up, leaving the bed, we are starting the day by leading ourselves, because we are making decision that, okay, whether I will start my day, how should I start my day, or should I just, you know, sleep one more hour. So everything starts with leading ourselves, then truly leading other people.
That's funny that you say deciding when, how we get out of bed and how we decide to get out of bed, and on the right side or the left side, if we're going to wake up and start our day with purpose and with an attitude of gratitude and being mindful of the rest we got, the rest we need. Kind of centering ourselves without jumping into the day with emails and reminding ourselves, what is our mission? What's important in life? And I like that from its startings, from the moment we open our eyes in the day, and leading with ourselves. That's right. Starting with ourselves.
And, you know, very simple definition for emotional intelligence is truly the way how we identify and control our emotions and along with others, truly not just making decision based on how we feel, regardless of not deciding or thinking about the consequences. So in simple word, emotional intelligence is truly being intelligent about our emotions rather than making the decisions instantly that can truly destroy the reputation.
So how do we do that, Farzana, knowing that I was recently on a call, and it was a coaching conversation, and someone in the field who's been coaching for decades now said, you know, what do you think the number one trigger is for physicians, like a stress trigger? You know, stress, we talk about stress is essentially unmet expectations. Unmet expectations result in stress. And he said, what do you think is a number one stress trigger for physicians? It's incompetence. So when physicians, and I would say almost any of us in academia, a trigger is when we perceive someone else as being incompetent or they're displaying incompetence, that triggers us. And I think that's a common, like, oh yeah, I bet you a lot of people's heads are nodding, because we pride ourselves so much in being so uber competent that when we feel like someone is not performing up to par or they're doing their job poorly, haphazardly, that really grates on our values of being competent. So, Farzana, when we're in the operating room, in the lab, in the clinic, in a meeting, on a Zoom call, and we feel triggered by what we perceive as someone else's, in this instance, incompetence, how do we fight that knowledge of self where my emotion wants to go, are you kidding me? How do you tame that monster for you? And how do you advise other folks to work with that understanding and then dealing with and learning and working with our own emotions?
I believe, you know, definitely, incompetence and other can be a reason for frustration for physicians. Along with that, we also need to be mindful that, you know, every person is different. Every person's trigger could be different. You know, some people may be getting upset with 1 minute late. Maybe other person is thinking that, okay, that's fine. 1 or 2 minute late is nothing. So truly, I should say two things we need to be mindful. One is self-awareness, understanding that what makes us frustrated, what triggers us, because it could be different for any of us. And also, it could be different every day. For example, when a person is hungry and getting upset with a different level of trigger compared to when a person maybe, you know, going through a happy moment, just got a good news, maybe that time that person will not be very frustrated with the same trigger. So the rule number one will be understanding our own self's trigger, what makes us happy, what makes us frustrated. That will be one thing, self-awareness. And second thing will be self-management. Because, you know, the reality is we cannot control other people. We can always and we should take the ownership of our emotions, of our actions, everything. So second thing will be self-management. So if I summarize that, okay, how to implement emotional intelligence in any situation, the first two things should be first self-awareness and second self-management.
Mm-hmm. And so what do I do if I can feel my blood boiling and I'm getting red in the face and I can feel a visceral reaction if I'm on a Zoom call somewhere and I sense that, I'm being triggered. What should we do in that moment or in those moments?
There are a couple of things we can do. And, you know, I recently wrote two papers in the Journal of Hospital Medicine. One paper was highlighting overall that three key area, how we can implement the emotional intelligence for leaders. And my second paper, which highlighted that how we can take rational decision when we are frustrated. And to answer your question, one of the biggest thing we can always do during any stressful situation that is taking pause. Because, you know, scientifically, we know that instantly when we are stressed, it's just instantly we are making reactions. That's the fight or flight response. You know, we cannot change it because this being human, and that's the nature safety to protect us from any danger. For example, if there is any earthquake, if we are in front of tiger, we want that reaction to run away instantly. At the same time, we cannot make those short-sighted reactions during our personal or professional lives. So that time, we have to give some pause to our brain, to our body, to adapt in that stressful situation. So pausing is extremely important during any stressful situation. For example, if you are getting a frustrated email, never ever email immediately during that situation. Take some moment to think, then give the response, because, you know, one of the leadership lesson is that never ever reply to any angry email instantly. So pausing during the stressful situation is crucial to manage ourselves.
That's I love that. Just take a deep breath. Kind of the breathing is a big start. You know, start. I think sometimes when I feel myself getting that way, I will literally kind of feel, because I feel my shoulders rising. I feel it getting tight. And so it's a matter of rolling my shoulders up and back, taking a very deep inhale, slow exhale, but trying to do this kind of not obviously. So if I'm mad at Dr. Hulk and she sees me going, my eyes are rolling, I'm exhaling, I'm like having this kind of like, oh, here we go. That's a little bit obnoxious. But being first, I'm aware, then I'm going to pause, center myself, gather my thoughts. And then I like how then I regulate myself. Like, what is the appropriate response? I'm a leader. If my dean were to be on this call right now, or if she was watching a recording of this Zoom call, or we're in the room, how would she assess me as a leader in my response here? And knowing that as a leader, other people are taking my temperature and watching me all the time. Dr. Luann Thorndike, one of the goddesses in our field of faculty affairs and development, would always tell us, people are watching you all the time. So what kind of a role model am I? Knowing that if I'm a good leader, I've already shared my triggers with my teammates. Listen, this is the best way to communicate with me. This is the best way to disagree with me. These are the things that will trigger me. So if I, as a leader, have shared that and my expectations, and now something has triggered that, everybody on my team or in my collaboration or in my clinic or wherever will know, uh-oh, this is one of Kim's bugaboos. Let's see how she handles it. So I'm thinking, I'm setting up a premise of, if I've communicated these things, how's best to communicate with me, disagree with me, talk with me. And then same way with my team members, I have to understand that maybe my perception of someone's not doing a job is because I said, will you do this, you know, quickly? And to her or him, quickly was within 5 days. I meant within an hour. So that's a bad on me that I was not explicit in understanding that is quick. So that communication back and forth. So I think that kind of leads to the social awareness. In one of your articles, you asked for social awareness. How do people experience me? And how do people experience themselves when they're with me? So that kind of leads into that social awareness. Do you want to kind of walk us through that component of it too, and then the relationships?
Absolutely. You know, so the emotional intelligence has like two parts. One is how we are controlling ourselves, that we talked about, self-awareness, self-management. And we know that, you know, at home, at our office, at our healthcare, alone, we cannot do anything, right? We need people. So understanding the social situation is very, very important. So the other part of the emotional intelligence is like social aspect, and that can be divided into two categories. One is social awareness, and second is relationship management. So if we talk about social awareness, as you mentioned very nicely, that how we know that whether we are socially aware or not, because, you know, people are always judging us, and particularly when we are leader, people are always, always judging us, monitoring us, making a lot of perception. So being social aware means how people are thinking about us, and also very importantly, how people are feeling about themselves when they are surrounding us. Because we have to remember that if anyone, any other people is not feeling comfortable or safe around leader, they will not be in their best potential. So not only about how they are feeling about me or you, also important that how they are feeling about themselves when they are surrounding by us. And many of you maybe saw that cartoon that, okay, there is a letter, one person is telling 6, another person is telling 9. Because, you know, perception is people's reality. Because the same thing maybe can be seen, the same elephant maybe judged by touched by 10 different people and 10 different perception can be gathered. So we have to remember to be fully socially aware that perception is reality. And truly, you know, perception management is very important for any leader. And you will see that during any big election, they have separate people who are managing that leader's perception. And same thing for us as well. We have to be mindful about what kind of perceptions are people creating about us.
I love the example, Dr. Hulk, you gave of the 6 or the 9, which is why when you, I'm trying to think of when we go out, at sporting events or like golf clubs or putt-putt or bingo, I'm trying to think of where they show numbers. They put an underline, an underscore underneath the 6, the 9 to make sure you don't have it upside down because it can be a 6 or a 9. And that's just a great illustration for how we can think we're saying one thing, or we're saying one thing, but it's received a completely different opposite, in this instance, a 6 or a 9, upside down. So we make a lot of assumptions, or we can make assumptions when we don't, in general, use your principle of pause. All right, what I heard me say was this, you know, what did you hear me say? And make sure we all have the same terminology, the same definition, the same expectations. What does soon mean to you? What does soon mean to me? Let's say within 7 days, by close of business, let's be very specific so there's no question. And I also really like how you reminded us that it's not only how our colleagues, our peers, our learners, our patients think about us, like, is she doing a good job? Is he, you know, exemplifying good leadership skills? But also, is he making me feel dumb? Does she make me feel nervous? I always leave these meetings feeling stupid or feel like I'm not good enough. That, how do I feel when I'm with my leader? Ideally, and again, this is not all sunshine and lollipops because sometimes we all drop the ball. Sometimes we all make mistakes. But as you said earlier, Farzana, if it's in a culture or an environment of safety and protection that people know, yeah, they're even more willing to say, I messed up, but they know that they're not going to get their head bitten off, that people will then speak up and say, yeah, this is, they're vigorous, they're interesting meetings, and I feel safe that I can speak up. I feel safe to disagree because my leader or the leader on this project has shared with me how he likes to be challenged, what triggers him, what his expectations are. So we're all clear. And the culture is one of let's all participate equally. And I feel good about that. And I feel like I'm a valued member. When he's in that room, I feel heard. I feel excited. I feel encouraged. I feel inspired. So that emphasis on awareness of how not only people are perceiving me, but how do they feel when they're with me is so, it's a nuance, but I see it on a lot of times our faculty members get in trouble because they're so driven for success and metrics and motivated to produce, that we can steamroll over people without being aware of, yeah, you get a lot done. Yeah, you get a lot of grants. Yeah, you see a lot of patients. Yeah, you're really respected by your peers, but you make everybody else feel like, you know, 1 inch tall. That's not good either.
And, you know, that's why it's very important to be mindful about the term psychological safety. Because if surrounding people are not feeling comfortable or safe, they are not going to give us that honest perspective or truly not be helpful. So I recently published an article in the Brown Journal of Hospital Medicine that how we can implement emotional intelligence in academia and particularly in medical education. And one of the important points where I emphasized that how much psychological safety is important for our learners, like for our medical students, for our residents, interns, and not only for them. When we are working with our colleagues, when we are working with our nurses, other ancillary staff, psychological safety is very, very important. And psychological safety is not only important for organizational productivity, according to the research, it is also important to establish trust and leaders' credibility. Because we have a lot of well-established research that how psychological safety promote a positive work environment, increase the productivity and retention. And, you know, we must have to be mindful that emotional intelligence is important for any of all the people. However, reality is for women physicians, for minority, this is very important, because I was listening a podcast where they are analyzing Barack Obama's speech. And they mentioned that, okay, how in different situation, Barack Obama never ever react. He was very calm, composed, because he could not take that risk of that bias that people have for African American, regardless of his president or not. So same thing, you know, I'm always mindful that, okay, I'm a woman of color. I came from an underserved community. So people may not see me as a leader all the time. However, how I can, you know, make response, how I can make decision, how I lead myself to establish my credibility, and emotional intelligence, being mindful, be a learner of emotional intelligence, truly empower me to do so.
Mm-hmm. I love that. Talking about what a great example of President Barack Obama. I guess I had never noticed that, but you're right. And this is where, you know, you would think that, well, I am who I am. How come I have to change me in this situation? And that's kind of a naive, because, you know, I coach a lot of faculty members and who are convicted that this is what got me here. I mean, this attitude, my personality, my stick-to-itiveness, my perseverance, my hard-driving, hard-working, it got me here. So what could be wrong with this? And then there's that book, Goldsmith, you know, book, What Got You Here Won't Get You There. Mm-hmm. The idea that, you know, at a certain point, maybe this has served you well. And so it seems like it's affirmation that, yes, this is, you have been successful getting here with that set, those set of characteristics or mannerisms. And now, you know, we have different seasons of life. You're in a different season of life. And maybe Barack Obama would have, and when he was community organizing, he was perhaps more responsive. But you're right. It's when you get a different platform, there's a different responsibility. And that responsibility is you can't just, or you will suffer the consequences if you project onto, this is me, take it or leave it, this is who I am, without being mindful of how that is being perceived. There's like the intention of my communication and the impact of my communication. So if I'm throwing a lot of words at someone who knows me and they're like, that's Kim, I got her, I'm with her, I'm jiving with her. But then a whole different group in that audience might be like, whoa, 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 what's up with this? And especially, you're right, when you put the layers of the onion or the different veils in front of us of adding different life circumstances. If I'm young, I'm old, I'm tall, I'm short, I'm handicapped, I have disabilities, I have a different religious this background or political persuasion or different color skin tone, all those other veils or layers that people are looking at us through, it can really change the message. So that really speaks to the importance of us being aware of that. Like, who is our audience? What am I saying? How will this be perceived? And not changing who we are, but being mindful of and pausing as you're being pausing to appreciate, is this the right choice of words? And then what do we do when we mess up, Farzana? What do we do when we say the wrong thing? Like, there have been times on this podcast where I'm like, should I say that? Is that okay to say that? I mean, what do you do when you say something that, oh gosh, I didn't mean to do it that way? How do we back out of that when you realize you've made an EI error, an emotional intelligence error? What do you do?
You know, to error is human. We are human being. We are first human, then we are physician, then we are physician leader. I believe, you know, at first we have to be mindful that none of us, doesn't matter how much we read or talk about emotional intelligence, we will never be 100% perfect. Like, you know, nobody can tell that, okay, I have these EQ skills I'm implementing 24/7. No, it's not possible. So first, being kind to ourselves, because, you know, we are always very much empathic to other people, but we forget that to ourselves. So mistakes happen. However, to admit it, that, okay, it happened, and not beating ourselves. So that should be the first step. Second, what we are learning from that mistake. Okay, so now the mistake happened. Okay, so what is the situation that it happened? Why it happened? Like, what was the trigger that made me upset? Maybe next time need to be cautious about that trigger. And then thirdly, will be again, you know, remind ourselves that, okay, none of us are inevitable in this world. Like, regardless of our job title, you know, we are a mortal human being. None of this is permanent in this world. So, you know, title comes and go, wealth comes and go. So we need to be humble that, okay, maybe today I'm the CEO, but tomorrow I do not have that position. So three things I would highlight if somebody is making mistake. One, be kind. Second, to learn from that mistake so that it does not happen again. And third, to remind ourselves again that, okay, regardless of our job title, nothing is permanent in this world. So we need to be humble and be grateful.
I love it. I love it. Yeah, this is, we could probably spend a whole nother segment talking about this, but I'm reminded of a recent conversation with someone who said, you know, we used to be able to joke in the office, and coming to the office was so fun, and we'd be laughing and telling stories. He's like, now I'm afraid to say anything to anybody. I can't tell jokes. I can't tell stories. I can't ask questions. I can't do anything. Going to work is not fun anymore. And you know, the context was, you know, he was having some challenges with some other faculty members who didn't take to his sense of humor and were offended by some of the things he said. And it was so difficult, because this man was truly happy-go-lucky, outgoing, extroverted. And I felt the pain of, you know, missing that sense of community and that sense of, you know, the good old days when we'd all have lunch together and it was joyful. And now, you know, post-COVID, it's all isolated. And then the added layer of the fear, his fear of saying the wrong thing to the wrong person and then getting in trouble. So I feel that tension, you know, I feel that conflict of wanting to bond, wanting to unite, wanting to connect with each other. And yet the nervousness about, I don't know, what can I connect about or connect on? So as a woman from an underrepresented background, what, from your perspective, what would you advise this man?
So I should say two things. First, the reality is, you know, doesn't matter how much collegial we are with our colleagues, we have to remember that our colleagues are not our friends. You know, we must have to be always professional and be mindful of that. Yeah, definitely our goal is to have good collegial environment, good relationship with them. And the research has been shown that when we have good relationship with our colleagues, that decrease burnout, increase the productivity, increase retention. Definitely we want that. At the same time, you know, there should be a professional barrier, because they are not our friends. And second thing is that emotional intelligence is also helpful to remind us about the cultural perspective, because, you know, now the workforce is very, very diverse. We have people from different country, different culture. What more may be appropriate in North America may not be at all acceptable in many countries of Asia. Mm-hmm. So the advice will be mindful of that cultural perception, but doesn't mean that, okay, we will be biased that, okay, this person is coming from this country, they will be like this, so we will avoid them. No, I'm not telling that. At the same time, I'm telling that be mindful of that cultural perception. For example, in America, to my knowledge, that people do not like if other person is coming to their personal space. In contrast, in some other country in Asia, maybe where people are interacting or communicating, they are coming much closer than what is the practice in America. So be mindful of those cultural expectations is always helpful to maintain that professional relationship.
Oh, Dr. Hope, I like the cultural perspective, the emphasis on, regardless of where we are, this is just a heightened sense of, this is the world we live in, what's very much mixing. And so it's so easy to put people in boxes. It's more interesting and a lot more fun when we approach this as, oh, this is someone new. I can't wait to get to know them. And pretending it's a blank slate, complete blank slate. Because, for example, I am always kindly, constructively criticized for being a close talker because I'm an extrovert. That's why I talk so much, because that's how I think, is by talking words, words, words. But I'm always wanting to be hugging and touching and talking and getting up close. And I did spend time in the Philippines as an exchange student, about a little over a year, about 13, 14 months when I was in high school. And that's where I learned the Philippines, the hugging that felt so natural to me. And when I was back home here, we weren't. So I picked that up and kept that because it felt so good to me. But I can see how it's so much easier and it's more efficient to run through the quick check boxes. Okay, woman from the South, you know, MD, PhD. So we're kind of like making a computing proper way to converse with this person. You don't know, this is a human being who has, so searching for commonalities, you know, outside of those kind of check boxes, like, yeah, last night I was playing pickleball. Oh, you play pickleball? Oh, me too. And all of a sudden, this is a three-dimensional human being without mind of the check boxes. So I think it's exciting to think of emotional intelligence as raising our awareness of, think of everyone as a blank slate, because we don't know, you never know by looking at someone who they are, what they believe in, what they're like, what they don't like. And that to me is kind of exciting, isn't it? To discover something brand new in someone that you would never have thought of. So, yeah, but I can see how this poor guy was flummoxed by this situation. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, we thought about how could you engage. And I also want to remember to underline what you said. Colleagues aren't friends. And some people, I'm sure, are like, oh, I thought I had friends at work. I think, you know, it's in what you're saying is that when we go to work, you're not in your family room. You're not in the locker mm-hmm. room. You're not at the bar at happy hour. So there is a time and place for everything. So there's a way of we wear different hats. You behave differently in synagogue or temple or in church than you do at work and at home. So that's an important reminder, since those lines have been so blurred between home and work. I think it is easy for people just to kind of shift and drift between both without realizing, wait a minute, this is a professional, prestigious university. I have important responsibilities. Maybe this kind of jokey behavior or profane languages or way of I'm dressing is not going to be perceived very well, or not does not reflect this institution. So that awareness of the culture in that institution, of fitting in or in that room, what is the culture in this meeting? What is the culture? What is the ecosystem here? And how can I manage myself in these relationships to fit into this culture?
I believe culture is very, very important. For example, you know, when I'm doing meeting with my, like the nursing director, nursing manager, maybe that time I'm wearing lab coat. However, the culture when I'm in a boardroom with like CEO, CMO, with the C-suite leader, that time I prefer to wear a coat rather than my lab coat. This is a very simple example because the culture is different, expectation is different. At some place, I'm expected to be a physician. At some place, I'm expected to be leader, physician leader. So mindful of culture is very important. I can share one very simple example. For example, in North America, I'm here now almost coming close to 10 years. And in US, small talk is very normal. Like, this is natural. We are expected to do so. People love it. In contrast, when I was in Paris, they do not care about small talk. You know, if you want to do a small talk, that will be seen as red flag. They are not very much interested about that small talk or that eye contact. So being mindful of that culture is very, very important. This is a very simple example I wanted to share.
Yeah, you're right. When you think about the Myers-Briggs, And as an extrovert, of course, and it's easier for a lot of people to recognize introverts versus extroverts. So when I'm with someone who I don't know, and I can watch them or listen to them or pay attention to them, and if their cadence of speaking maybe quieter, softer, slower, I will automatically try to slow myself down, slow my tone, my volume, my pace to match theirs, because I don't want to be in their face, obnoxious, words, you know, shooting at them and just completely overwhelming and taking over the space by my big extroverted face and my big mouth. So that's how it's like, I think that paying attention to, oh, okay, this is how, you know, this is a comfortable rhythm. Let me kind of match this rhythm. And it's to establish relationships, to establish good relationships. Doesn't mean I'm being disingenuous. It means I'm calibrating, because we can all flex both ways. We can all be a bit of an extrovert. We can all be a bit of an introvert. So that's really smart if you can learn to be both a thinker and a feeler, a sensor and an intuiter, judger and perceiver. If you can flex our styles depending on the situation, that situational awareness will help us in meeting the mission, meeting goals, and achieving great success. We can leverage all the power of all the people by showing emotional intelligence and sharing that emotional intelligence and modeling the way.
Absolutely. You know, emotional intelligence, in my view, is a superpower, because it's nothing like dishonest or not being yourself. It's truly bring your best foot forward, unlocking your potential, be the best version of yourself by controlling, managing your emotion, by controlling and managing reputation, so that, you know, you are fully bloomed before our time is to go to in this earth, just to make sure that, okay, we are contributing to our highest potential in this world through emotional intelligence. You know, before you wrap up, I wanted to share three tips to hone our emotional intelligence, please.
Close us out, please.
Three tips, I found those are truly actionable and practical to hone our emotional intelligence and practice in our daily life. The first one is truly the sponsor of ourselves. I know that in academic medicine, we always look for a sponsor to promote ourselves, to talk about ourselves. However, if we are not sponsoring ourselves, if we are not mindful of our own advancement, no sponsor can do that. So first, identify that, okay, which area of emotional intelligence need to work on, and then work on those to bring your best foot forward. The second tips will be self-talk. Particularly, you know, the research has been shown that female, we tend to ruminate. You know, we are always very much harsh on ourselves, not very kind. If we make any mistakes, we like, you know, punish ourselves more than maybe other people are thinking. So it's a message for all of us, particularly for women leaders, that please be kind to yourself. If you are making any mistakes, learn from it and move on. If it is not making any impact in next maybe, you know, 5 months, 5 years, please learn from it and move on. And thirdly is visualization. Visualization is the technique that any great athletes are practicing, and they have been advised by their coach. This is scientifically proven technique. So visualize your success, visualize your best self, visualize that position or the goal you want to achieve. That visualization will empower you. So at the end of the day, I believe that emotional intelligence is a great power, and all of us has a space, has the potential to learn it, to master it, so that, you know, we can be the best version of ourselves.
Well said. Thanks for being on the podcast. We'll talk to you folks next time on the Faculty Factory podcast. Bye, Farzana.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Hey there, Faculty Factory listeners. As of April 1st, 2024, this podcast has had nearly 92,000 total downloads and YouTube views from listeners in 95 different countries. FacultyFactory.org has drawn over 42,000 web visits from users in 122 different countries. We are an international platform, and we would love to invite you to be a guest on our show. Our host, Dr. Kimberly Skorupski, makes this a very engaging and relaxing environment. And as the producer, I'll make any edits on the back end if you need it. Reach out if you'd like to be a guest or to nominate someone in our academic medicine community to be a guest. Visit the Contact Us page on facultyfactory.org to send us a message, or contact Dr. Skorupski directly at kskorupski@jhmi.edu.
Thanks for tuning in to Faculty Factory Podcast. The mission of the Faculty Factory is to build and support a community of leaders in faculty development who share tools, resources, wisdom, and encouragement in service to our faculty members, schools, and institutions. We encourage you to go to facultyfactory.org to find out more, get in touch with me, ask me any questions. Maybe you want to be interviewed on the podcast. Thanks for tuning in to Faculty Factory Podcast. We'll see you next time.
The Faculty Factory podcast and website is sponsored by the Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine Office of Faculty. For more information, visit facultyfactory.org.